This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
Tonight, on a special two-hour edition of Unsolved Mysteries, the strange and mysterious saga of the Circleville Letters. For 18 years, residents of a small town in Ohio had been deluged with anonymous death threats, slanderous accusations, and even a lethal booby trap. Many believe this vicious campaign has led to the death of one man and the unjust imprisonment of another. From England, a spellbinding case that's not only in the grand tradition of Agatha Christie, it's about Agatha herself. In 1926, as her marriage was unraveling, the best-selling mystery writer of all time vanished without a trace, leaving the authorities to figure out who done it and why. In December of 1991, 21-year-old Tommy Burkett was found shot to death in his bedroom. Just minutes after arriving at the scene, investigators told Tommy's parents that their son had committed suicide. But now Tommy's mother and father believe they have unearthed a chilling scenario of murder, which may implicate the local police. Legend has it that beneath the remote chilly waters of Lake Michigan lies a sunken fortune. 5 chests stuffed with gold and bullion worth millions. Tonight we'll join a dangerous underwater quest to find the Poverty Island treasure. Also tonight we'll take you to the phone center for a very special milestone. The solving of our 200th mystery. And a very special update. The reunion of a GI and the buddy who saved his life in Vietnam. Join me for 2 hours of intriguing cases and a celebration of 200 solves on Unsolved Mysteries. In December of 1993, Unsolved Mysteries received this postcard. It was not exactly in the vein of our usual viewer mail. The card read, "Forget Circleville, Ohio. Do nothing to hurt Sheriff Radcliffe. If you come to Ohio, you El Sickos will pay. The Circleville Writer." It's not often that we become part of a story we're investigating. But in this case, it didn't come as a total surprise. For the past 18 years, residents in and around Circleville, Ohio, have received literally thousands of bizarre letters and postcards. They represent an insidious campaign of character assassination, which some believe has left one man dead and another unfairly imprisoned. Circleville, Ohio, 30 miles south of Columbus, is a place that rarely attracts outside attention. In fact, the town's main claim to fame is its annual pumpkin show. For years, Circleville was a stable workaday community. Then in 1976, the letters started.
One of the very first letters, if not the first letter, was received by Mary Gillespie, a school bus driver, telling her that the letter writer was aware that she was having an affair with the superintendent of schools, and that it had better stop.
In addition to allegations of an affair, the letter carried an ominous threat.
"I know where you live. I've been observing your house and know you have children. This is no joke. Please take it serious."
The envelope is postmarked Columbus, Ohio. There was no return address outside, no signature inside, no way to tell whether it came from a man or a woman. Within 8 days, Mary Gillespie had received another letter similar in tone.
Mary?
Mary apparently kept the letters to herself until her husband, Ron, received one as well.
What's going on?
All right, I already got two of these, okay? And I didn't say anything because it's not true.
What do you mean you got two of these? Why didn't you say something?
Because I thought they would just go away. And
in this letter, addressed to Ron Gillespie, told him that if he didn't do something to stop this affair, that his life was undoubtedly in danger.
The alleged affair was a rumor tailor-made to set any small town on its ear. The superintendent of schools and a school bus driver. Soon the anonymous writer was threatening to go public.
Gillespie, you have had 2 weeks and done nothing. Make her admit the truth and inform the school board. If not, I will broadcast it on CBs, posters, signs, and billboards until the truth comes out.
Mary and Ron evidently confided in three family members, Ron's sister, her husband Paul Freshour, and Paul's sister.
What was that movie? It was in black and white, where they wrote letters. They thought they knew who the suspects were, so they wrote letters to them.
I know who you are.
Mary had some ideas about who was sending the letters, and she had a plan.
Letters back, telling them we know who they are.
Oh, you do it. You print well. What do we say?
Just like the letters.
We know who you are.
We thought we'd, scare the guy. We did 4 or 5 letters only, nothing. There was no violence in him or anything, just that we knew who he was and what he was doing, and we sent him the letters.
For a while, the plan worked. The threatening letters stopped. Then on August 19th, 1977, Ron Gillespie got a phone call.
Who is this? No, you listen to me. We're sick of this, okay? No more letters, no more phone calls. We're sick of the whole thing. Just end it, all right?
No one knows what the caller actually said, but the call apparently confirmed Ron's suspicions about the identity of the letter writer.
He told the children he was going out, he was going to confront the letter writer. He took his weapon. He did not seem to be drunk. Said goodbye to his children and went out.
In the heat of the moment, Ron Gillespie ran to the family's red and white pickup, even though the letter writer had often referred to the fact that he or she was watching that truck. Perhaps Ron didn't remember. Perhaps he was too angry to care.
Within a short distance at an intersection that he knew very well, he lost control of the vehicle, hit a tree, and was killed. Somewhere in between leaving the house and hitting that tree, his gun had fired one shot. And there was never any explanation for when or how at whom that gun could have been fired.
Pickaway County Sheriff Dwight Radcliffe, who declined to be interviewed for this story, supposedly investigated and eliminated at least one suspect. He then ruled Ron Gillespie's death an accident. But several Circleville residents soon received anonymous letters saying that Sheriff Radcliffe was perpetrating a cover-up.
First of all, the sheriff agreed with me there was foul play. And then when I contacted him again, he changed his attitude completely. Then he was telling me that it wasn't foul play, that it was the suspect had passed a polygraph test.
Gillespie had 0.16% alcohol, which would, in Ohio, be 1.5 times the legal limit. Most people I've talked to said that he was not a heavy drinker and were surprised by that kind of finding.
Was Ron Gillespie's death an accident? Was he really drunk that night? And why had one bullet been fired from his handgun? 6 years after the death of Ron Gillespie, the Circleville, Ohio letter writer was still waging his or her vicious campaign. The initial targets, Ron's wife Mary and the superintendent of schools, eventually acknowledged a relationship, but both claimed it had begun after the letters rather than before. Mary was still driving a school bus to support her family. In 1983, the letter writer began to put up signs along her bus route. Finally, Mary's daughter was targeted. Mary Gillespie had had enough.
She ripped the sign down. Much to her surprise, behind the sign was this box and some string and also another post that was attached to the fence post. She took it into the bus and she opened up this rather unusual sized box. As she opened it up, there was a small pistol.
On closer examination, Mary realized that it was a crude booby trap designed to fire the gun at her. An amateurish attempt had been made to rub the serial number off the handgun. When lab tests were able to raise it again, the case took an incredible turn. The gun belonged to Mary Gillespie's brother-in-law, Paul Freshour, who had just split up with Ron's sister.
I admitted the gun was mine, but I hadn't seen it for a long time. I'd had no reason to check up on or anything, and I don't know when it come up missing. I really don't know what happened to it, and I told him that, and that's the truth. And that's how it was.
Okay, Paul. On February 25th, 1983, Sheriff Radcliffe called Paul Freshour in for questioning and asked him to take a handwriting test.
We don't have all the answers we'd like to have just yet, okay? What I'd like you to do is to take this.
Under the impression he was helping to protect another family member, Paul agreed. The sheriff told him only that the missing gun was somehow linked to the Circleville letters.
This is an actual letter. I want you to copy as closely as you can on the pad what you see here. In other words, write what they have written.
He would give me an actual letter and ask me maybe to do the envelope part, just as near as I could in the envelope. And then on some, he would take the actual letter out and have me to do them as near as I could on the letters from what, you know, from right there in front of me. And I did them because I knew I wasn't responsible for the letters. And I knew the evidence would clear me. And then he dictated letters and he asked me to, recopy in my mind the same way on this dictation as I had recopied from the actual letters and envelopes.
Everyone is talking.
He made sure that I did him, you know, in the reference of how I'd copied him, because that was very important to him. And I did the best I could and turned everything into it.
That is not the proper way to test to see if someone has a certain writing style, because if they're copying from a letter, they're going to try to emulate the style. So, and the experts said that the testing was improper. So they didn't really say that these letters were written by Paul Freshour. They said that they could have been.
Right, pardon the mess, but I usually try to keep it a little cleaner than this.
After the handwriting test, a still unsuspecting Paul Freshour took Sheriff Radcliffe to his garage.
Sometimes I used to keep it up here, and then on top of the refrigerator.
Paul showed the sheriff where he had kept his gun. Afterwards, the two men returned to the courthouse.
I didn't think about it.
He called in the prosecutor and told the prosecutor that was my writing on the booby trap. And then the prosecutor is the one that actually told me that there was a booby trap found and I was under arrest for attempted murder and placed on a $50,000 cash bond.
On October 24th, 1983, Paul Freshour went on trial for the attempted murder of his sister-in-law, Mary Gillespie.
Yeah.
Even though Paul wasn't charged with writing the threatening letters, they became a crucial part of the evidence against him. What you are about to hear is verbatim testimony from court transcripts.
And did you explain to the handwriting analyst how you went about obtaining the samples?
Yes, I did.
And did he indicate which part of these he would actually use in his analysis?
The ones we dictated were the ones that would be used for comparison, not the ones he copied.
It is my opinion that the handwriting on the envelopes, documents, and postcards were printed by the same person. it being the known handwriting, or handprinting, of Paul Freshour.
Have you at any time suspected the defendant of being the one responsible for writing these letters and putting these signs up?
Not at first.
Well, when was your first indication that you had where someone indicated that it could possibly be him?
It was August of 1982, and his wife came to see me and indicated it might be a possibility.
Yeah, this is the weekly time record for Paul Freshour for the week ending 2-12-83.
And what days was Paul Freshour working that week?
Mr. Freshour worked Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of that week.
Did he work Monday?
No, he did not.
And
the Monday in question was the very day that Mary Gillespie had found the sign and booby trap. On that Monday. Even though Paul Freshour had an alibi for almost the entire day, he never took the stand in his own defense. It was a decision which Paul would come to regret.
We, the jury, find the defendant Paul L. Freshour guilty of attempted murder. We further find and specify that the defendant did have a firearm under his control.
I couldn't believe it. I was just in shock. And I know they put in some good evidence, and there was evidence withheld, but still yet, I mean, you know, I can't blame the jury, because the jury didn't hear all the evidence. But I was just, I just couldn't believe it. I was really in shock, you know, and I was probably in shock for a year after I was in prison. Unbelievable.
Paul Freshour was given the maximum sentence for attempted murder, 7 to 25 years. Everyone assumed Paul had written the Circleville letters, and everyone assumed that with Paul behind bars, the letters would stop. Everyone was wrong.
They were being received all over a large area of central Ohio. So a lot of people couldn't understand how Paul Freshour could be mailing all these letters from prison.
Following repeated complaints from Sheriff Radcliffe, Paul was placed in solitary confinement. Still, the letters continued. All of them were postmarked Columbus, even though Paul was imprisoned in Lima, Ohio, 200 miles away.
You go into a single man cell and that's it. You know, it's nothing in there with you. No pencils, no papers, no nothing. Restrictions, you wouldn't believe. Pat down, cell searches, visit monitoring, mail, in-going, out-going mail, always examined and tested, and maybe some days I'd get my mail, maybe some days I wouldn't.
We have, of course, reviewed your file in preference to your visit with us today. And although we find some nice things about you in the file, there are also some things that concern us a great deal.
After 7 years in prison, Paul Freshour became eligible for parole. In the weeks preceding his hearing, the volume of anonymous letters increased dramatically. Despite the Columbus postmarks, the letters worked against Paul. He was denied parole, even though he was universally regarded as a model prisoner. A few days later, the letter writer sadistically wrote a letter to Paul himself.
Now, when are you going to believe you aren't going to get out of there? I told you 2 years ago, when we set them up, they stay set up. Don't you listen at all? No one wants you out. No one. The joke is on you. Ha, ha.
Full-scale investigations were conducted twice, possibly three times, during which Paul Freshour was put into isolation, and the warden of the prison he was in during one of these investigations then wrote a letter to Paul's wife saying that as far as he was concerned, it was impossible for Paul to be writing these letters and sending them from prison.
When Martin Yant reviewed the sheriff's investigative file, he uncovered evidence never mentioned at the trial, which he believes might have kept Paul Freshour out of prison altogether.
Mary Gillespie told the sheriff that one of the other bus drivers told her that she had been driving that same road about 20 minutes before Mary Gillespie found that booby trap at exactly that site. And when she went by that very same intersection, there was a yellow El Camino parked there. A large man with sandy hair was standing there. When he saw her come, he turned around and acted like he was going to the bathroom or something, but seemed also to be avoiding any kind of identification. The description of the individual does not fit Paul Freshour at all, and Paul had a very solid alibi for this time of day. There was no attempt at all to follow up on that lead. And if they had, as I say, they would have found that another possible suspect in this case had a brother who had a yellow El Camino.
In May of 1994, Paul Freshour was finally granted parole after serving 10 years. To this day, he staunchly maintains his innocence, and he is sure that the real criminal is still at large.
I'd really like to see someone really look at this case on the letters. Reopen the letter part of it and get in and find out who wrote the letters. I'd also like to see someone look into this to my former brother-in-law's death. Look, that's not my family anymore, and, you know, that's my past. I'm not even going to look back at it. I've got a new family and a new future, but I still would like to see someone look at that accident real close and the letters. And that's what I'd really ask.
So many questions remain in this most bizarre case. Who did write the Circleville letters? At whom did Ron Gillespie fire his gun? Did that person kill Ron? Who was responsible for the booby trap found by Mary Gillespie? And finally, who stole Paul Freshour's pistol? When we return, Agatha Christie, the world's most renowned mystery writer, becomes a focal point of her own tantalizing unsolved mystery. In 1823, the poet Lord Byron wrote, "Truth is always strange, stranger than fiction." Just over a century later, the great mystery writer Agatha Christie, author of such famous novels as Murder on the Orient Express and Ten Little Indians, would prove that Byron was right. You see, when Agatha was 36 years old, she became the subject of her own real-life unsolved mystery, demonstrating that truth is not only stranger than fiction, often is directly related. On the morning of December 4th, 1926, Agatha Christie's car was found abandoned, about an hour's drive from her home on the outskirts of London. Agatha had apparently vanished into thin air, but some suspected the worst, that her husband Archie had done her in.
The press was fascinated, so was the public. Agatha was a famous woman. She was known to be a mistress of mysteries. This was a real-life mystery.
The story was taken up with great glee by newspapers around England. What had become of Agatha Christie? How could one of the most well-known women in the country have disappeared off the face of the earth? She was born Agatha Miller in 1890. Her father was a wealthy American, her mother a proper British lady. Agatha was raised in the moneyed upper middle class of English society. In 1914, Agatha broke an existing engagement to marry Colonel Archibald Christie, a dashing pilot in the Royal Flying Corps. Archie had pursued Agatha aggressively, even though many thought they were opposites in every way.
Everybody tells them it's a bad idea. It's the war. They get married on Christmas Day. And he immediately goes off to the war. A very, very traditional and romantic tale.
While Archie was fighting in the skies over France, Agatha worked as a nurse and in her spare time launched a writing career. creating the famous Belgian detective, H. Hercule Poirot. Agatha's first book, published 4 years after the war, was called The Mysterious Affair at Stiles.
That first book was a sensation. She didn't expect anything like that. And nobody expected it from a rather plump, placid, ordinary-looking girl. She hit the jackpot straight away.
The next three or four books did a little better each time. And then with her fifth book, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, she really hits the big time.
In 1926, Agatha, Archie, and the young daughter Rosalind moved into a mansion which they named Stiles after Agatha's first novel. Archie had been successful in his own right, a retired war hero turned investment banker. On the surface, the Christies looked like the picture-perfect family.
Archie was a real stockbroker. He was a British, proper, upper-crust, boring man who looked good. He was extremely conventional.
I'm playing golf at the weekend. Care to join me?
I don't believe I can.
That's your way.
Agatha looked conventional, but inside she wasn't. Inside, she wanted more.
Later in 1926, when Agatha's mother, Clara, died, the strained civility of Agatha and Archie's marriage cracked.
Agatha was absolutely distraught for the death of her mother. I think she had really never left the mother's side, and this is possibly one of the reasons why the marriage wasn't a great success, that she still remained very much a family girl. And when the mother died, it really unhinged her a bit.
Agatha took Rosalind and her nanny to Ashfield, a rambling Edwardian home where Agatha had grown up. Ostensibly, the move was temporary, to sort through her late mother's possessions, but it dragged on for weeks. Archie stayed away. Agatha's grief for her mother was too deep to fathom.
At 36, I think most women would mourn their mothers, but with Agatha Christie, it wasn't just sorrow. It was something approaching melancholia. It was an almost pathological condition, I think. And so she lived at Ashfield in this terrible sense of disorientation, physical stress, with no one to confide in, looking forward to the point when Archie would come down and celebrate with her their daughter's birthday.
Agatha, please do sit down.
The birthday celebration did not play out as Agatha had hoped.
Agatha, I want you to give me a divorce.
A divorce?
That's what I want.
No, Archie. Absolutely not. Never.
That's what I want, Agatha. I will not be moved.
It seemed that Archie had become involved with a woman named Nancy Neal.
Well, this was absolutely devastation for her. She had been betrayed. She never thought that a man could do this to her. I think she would have even lived with Archie having a mistress. But the fact that he wanted to divorce her destroyed her.
In a last-ditch effort to save her marriage, Agatha took Rosalind and moved back home.
I think you should stay at Stiles this weekend, Archie. We could spend some time alone together.
Excuse me.
On December 3rd, 1926, Archie took off alone, bound for a weekend house party. By some accounts, Archie and Agatha argued bitterly before he left. Agatha must have suspected that he planned to rendezvous with Nancy Neal. With Archie gone, Agatha was left to stew in her own misery.
Either at 9:30 at night or around 11 o'clock at night, according to different reports, she left the house in something of a state. The maids were alarmed by the way she went out. We know that she took with her a small traveling case and that she wore her fur coat.
Agatha left behind at least two notes. One was addressed to her secretary, asking that she cancel Agatha's weekend appointments. Another of unknown content was addressed to Archie.
Superintendent.
Right. Show me what you got, Constable.
The next morning, Agatha's abandoned car was found just an hour's drive from Stiles.
Again, the exact time seems to be in doubt. It had gone off the side of the road. It was not turned over. There had been no big accident.
A local man found the car on his way to work, sir.
The license was in her case. That's how we know it's Mrs. Christie. Her coat's still in the car, sir.
Cold night to be out without a coat.
Very cold indeed, sir.
What's this?
Her luggage, sir. One small bag.
Three dresses, two pairs of shoes, and this, sir.
Very nice. Thank you, Constable.
Archie Christie had been tracked down at his house party. He made an unfortunate appearance at the very moment the authorities were beginning to suspect foul play.
Superintendent.
Well, Christie.
Who are all these people?
Oh, just the curious, sir.
Well, they've got to be here.
Too late to stop them now, sir. They know the gist of it already.
Colonel Christie, have you any idea where your wife might be?
No, sir, none. I haven't a clue.
Pardon me for asking, but, where were you last night?
I was away, at friends.
You were?
Yes, Superintendent, I was.
Excuse me, sorry to bother you. Just one question about Colonel Christie. Just one question. Was the Colonel asking for a...
The press had already gotten
Constable,
wind of the event.
Away from the house and keep the,
superintendent went to Stiles to question Agatha's secretary and other staff members. No one was able to shed any light on Agatha's strange disappearance.
Have you spoken to the staff?
Yes, sir, I have.
The police launched vigorous attempts to find a body. There is a small pool nearby called the Silent Pool, which Agatha had, in fact, used in one of her previous stories. And this is dragged, I think, at least twice. They enrolled the public and I think even parts of the army in kind of beating the bushes, quite literally. Dorothy Alsayers and her husband engaged in this very activity. So there were days of searching. Meanwhile, the press is trying to investigate every angle on the case. They very rapidly get onto the Nancy Neal angle. That is to say, they start putting two and two together. Colonel Christie wasn't at home. And the plot they start to evolve is, in fact, a murder plot, possibly a suicide plot. She has been driven to suicide by the cruelty of her husband and his infidelity. Or, even more interesting, she is refusing to divorce him, and so he decides to make away with her. And the fact that so many of the elements in the situation mirror Agatha Christie's own published fiction makes the whole thing so much more fascinating.
Fascinating indeed. All the more so when witnesses came forward to say they had seen Agatha Christie. The first, a workman named Ernest Cross, was trekking to his job on the morning of Agatha's disappearance.
You all right, Mom?
What are you doing here?
Cross said Agatha seemed distraught. She wore only a thin dress, despite the chilly weather.
I can't start it. I've tried.
Can I help you then?
Will you? Oh, please.
Certainly. Oh,
very good. Very good. I'll just get in.
All right, then.
According to Ernest Cross, Agatha drove off in the opposite direction from Newland's Corner, the village where her car would later be found. The plot thickened. If Agatha Christie was dead, she certainly had a strange habit of popping up all over the countryside.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell me where I am?
Yes, ma'am. You're in Guildford in Surrey.
Is that the train?
Yes.
Two railroad porters who spoke with Agatha outside the station in Guildford assumed she had boarded a train.
Thank you.
11 days later, the final chapter of Agatha's adventure would be acted out. The scene, an elegant health spa in Harrogate, 200 miles from her home. An alert musician in the dance band notified authorities that Agatha Christie, using an assumed name, was a guest at the spa. The superintendent wasted no time bringing Archie Christie up to Harrogate.
Where shall I wait?
Right here in the foyer, sir. She'll have to pass through here.
Where have you been?
Just through there.
How long shall I wait?
Until she passes by, sir.
Very well. Agatha.
Dear brother, you come to take me home.
Brother?
Oh, Archie, it's so good to see you.
For reasons known only to herself, Agatha at first identified Archie as her brother, not her husband.
We've been searching everywhere for you. The police thought you were dead.
Is this your wife, Colonel?
Yes, it is.
Mrs. Christie.
Hello.
Agatha, please, we must talk. Come with me.
What I would like to know is what happened when Archie and she went upstairs that night. And they sat in that room all night talking. I mean, did they give each other hell or what? That's what I think nobody, of course, will know. And did he say, well, I have no intention of ever coming back to you? I think he must have, because that was the end. That was the tragic moment that night.
How long have you been in Harrogate, Mrs. Christie? Is there another man involved?
Agatha and Archie made their getaway from the spa amid nearly hysterical press hoopla.
Christie, we have some comments, please.
Both refused to comment about Agatha's mysterious disappearance, so reporters all over England began to dig furiously. Backed up by Agatha's doctors and encouraged by her family, the press at last concluded that Agatha Christie had been suffering from amnesia.
I believe that Christie had a definitive and terrible fight with her husband. It drove her over the edge. She had been depressed. Now she becomes, on some level, psychotic. She is not herself. She takes on another identity. She wanders off. She gets on the train. She takes another name. She goes into this hotel, and she lives another life.
Dear brother, you've come to take me home.
That's very, very, very rare, but it's known, it's documented in the annals of psychology. And we know that Agatha Christie was an unusual woman.
Well, I think, and from my elderly age, I think she plotted and planned it from the start. It was, she went to the only thing she knew, she went and used the media that she knew, which was revenge, mystery, possibility of murder. She checked into this hotel under the name, I think it's just madly funny, she checked in using the name of the girlfriend, Neil.
Table for one for Theresa Neil.
I think she took endless delight in the fact that the police shadowed Archie. Poor Archie had a hell of a life. He couldn't go anywhere because they suspected him of murdering her. And I think she took marvellous delight in reading this in the papers. Again, I think, in a sort of revenge and twisted up sort of way, she was thinking. But it was very funny.
Agatha and Archie Christie quickly went their separate ways. Agatha married eminent archaeologist Max Mollowan in 1930, 2 years after Archie had wed Nancy Neal. By all accounts, both couples had long, happy marriages. Agatha Christie went on to write more than 100 novels, becoming the best-selling mystery writer of all time. In her later years, Agatha also wrote her autobiography, but it would not be published until after her death in 1975. Agatha's curious fans had waited 50 years to have her strange disappearance explained once and for all, but she wrote not one word about it. Agatha Christie, mistress of mystery to the end, had taken her secret to the grave. Next, a very special celebration, the solving of our 200th mystery. For the past 7 years, the phone center has been an integral part of our operation, providing the crucial link with you, our viewers. Recently, activity at the phone center took on added excitement as we counted down to a very special milestone, the solving of our 200th mystery. Since our first broadcast in 1987, scenes like this have become a familiar and welcome sight. Thanks to your alert tips, more than 100 fugitives have been captured all across the country, and even in such faraway places as Panama and Central America, and the island of American Samoa in the South Pacific. No less important are the heartfelt reunions of separated family members and long-lost friends. To date, your calls have helped us solve 63% of our lost love cases, a success rate beyond our wildest dreams. As we approached the magic number of 200, each call to the phone center was met with rising anticipation, and the final solves reflected the diversity of our show. A mother and daughter separated by adoption in 1937. A man wanted for murder. A suspected con artist. Two sisters who had not seen each other in more than 20 years.
It's so good to see you.
And now there are 200, all made possible by you, our viewers. Since today is Veterans Day, it seems only appropriate that we celebrate our 200th solve with the uplifting story of a friendship forged by the difficulties of war.
We're gonna take a little run!
In 1964, 19-year-old Mitchell Shigemoto of Honolulu, Hawaii, made it through a rigorous training course to join the prestigious 173rd Airborne Division of the United States Army. The next year, Mitchell and his unit were transferred to Vietnam. At the front, within the ranks of his own army, Mitchell ran into a strange bias. He looked just like the enemy.
Move on, Jap.
Hey, you got a problem?
Yeah, I don't serve zipper heads.
Let's go.
You want to go?
Come on. Come on.
What's the problem? Why don't you just do your job and serve the soldier?
Right, just relax, no, okay?
But one soldier, James Pearson, stood up for Mitchell.
All right, just take it easy.
Mitchell and James had become best friends when they were posted in Okinawa en route to Vietnam. On January 2nd, 1966, their unit ran into heavy fire. When Mitchell Shigemoto caught a bullet in the thigh, James Pearson came to the rescue.
Turn to the right!
There was one sniper that was keying in on us. James took a position right in front of me, just like he was trying to block off the shots, you know. James actually saved my life. What I say to him, I say, James, I never had a chance to thank you personally. I want to thank you now. I really appreciate everything that he did for me.
What James did for Mitchell was against regulations. He and another soldier temporarily left the firing line in order to carry Mitchell to safety. A few weeks later, Mitchell was sent home to Hawaii. He never saw James Pearson again and never had the opportunity properly thank the man who saved his life. After our broadcast, all that would change in a most remarkable way. A viewer in San Bernardino, California, retired Lieutenant Colonel Truman Plants, took it upon himself to track down James Pearson. 1 week later, Lieutenant Colonel Plants found him in Chicago. And before long, James, his fiancée, and his two grown daughters were on their way to Hawaii to visit Mitchell Shigemoto and his family. As Mitchell's relatives gathered to welcome James, the two old comrades caught their first glimpse of one another in nearly 30 years.
Mitchell!
How you doing, pal?
Great.
It's great to see you. Great to see you.
You still look the same.
It was complete, total joy. Happiness. Just great to see you. I had to compose myself, you know. It was just completely overwhelming.
Thank you.
And unbelievable. Connie, how are you?
Mitchell's wife, Connie, greeted James in traditional Hawaiian fashion. After all, this was the man who saved her husband's life.
I really did. And who is this one? The bottom line, I wasn't going to leave him out there alone under those conditions. I couldn't have did it. Well, regulations permitted it, rules permitted it, or not. I just couldn't have did it.
It took a lot from a real special person to do something like that. And my wife, she, you know, when she heard that story, she made it a point to try to locate him with no success until we found you guys.
That's my next objective. Okay.
James spent a full week in Hawaii with Mitchell. The two of them never stopped talking about the past and the future, planning the time when they would see each other again.
So how's it feel to be back together?
They haven't come up with that word yet. When they come up with that word, I'll write you and let you know. But there's no word for this feeling, you know, for right now. They haven't come up with that word.
Stay tuned in the next hour for these intriguing mysteries. When police conclude that a young college student has committed suicide, his parents launch their own investigation and reach their own disturbing conclusion. In Massachusetts, authorities need your help to track down a man who killed his wife's sister and journey into the murky depths of Lake Michigan in search of a legendary treasure worth millions. When he died at the age of 21, Tommy Burkett was a junior at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia, just down the road from Washington, D.C. Tommy's parents lived some 20 miles from the campus. His mother, Beth George, was an instructor there.
I thought I left the lights on. Tommy!
On Sunday, December 1st, 1991, Tommy was at home after the Thanksgiving holiday.
Tommy!
His parents had been out for much of that afternoon. When they returned to the house at about 6:10 p.m.,
Tommy?
They confronted an unimaginable horror. Tommy was upright on the sofa in his bedroom. He had been shot once through the mouth. A revolver rested in his hands.
No, don't go in there. I'm going to call 911.
Virtually from the moment police arrived on the scene that night, they have insisted that Tommy Burkett committed suicide. Case closed. But Tommy's parents, Beth George and Tom Burkett, have amassed compelling evidence that their son was in fact murdered. They have pieced together a chilling scenario that they claim implicates officials from both the Fairfax County, Virginia Police Department and the United States Drug Enforcement Agency. Tom and Beth's suspicions began within minutes of discovering their son's body.
I went over close to him, and I knelt down beside him, and I touched his hands. They were stone cold.
It's gonna be all right.
But I just kept saying over and over that everything would be all right, and that we would find them, and that we loved him.
Tom. That gun. Something's not right.
In the emotion of the moment, Tom picked up the revolver. He was surprised to find its cylinder unlatched. Surprised because the gun could not have been fired in that condition.
133.
paramedics arrived at 6:20 p.m.
Is there anything you can do for him?
No. There's nothing more we could do. It's been several hours. I'm sorry.
After fire and rescue left, the uniformed officer entered the house immediately, and he was in a hurry, which I thought was strange because my son was dead.
Don't blame yourself.
I responded, I don't blame myself. And he said, well, I've seen hundreds of these suicides, and there was nothing you could have done.
The lead detective arrived and went up to Tommy's room. According to Beth and Tom, he soon emerged with an old bank deposit slip.
I have something to show you.
On one side was a note which said simply, I want to be cremated.
This is Tommy's handwriting.
The fire and rescue squad said Tommy's been dead for hours.
No, that's not true. It just happened. Probably happened while you were coming down the street.
I was dumbfounded at that comment because it didn't take a medical person to recognize that Tommy had been dead for several hours. He was cold, he was stiff, blood had dried. Any layman would have said several hours.
Major Art Mabry is a spokesperson for the Fairfax County Police.
The gun was processed, an autopsy was conducted, photographs were taken. A thorough and acceptable crime scene was conducted.
To the police, the facts spoke for themselves. Tommy's death was an open and shut case of suicide, but the facts told a different story to Beth George. She was certain her son had been murdered, the suicide staged. It was not just the unlatched gun and the suspicious note. Tommy's glasses, wallet, and driver's license were missing. 2 days after Tommy's death, his parents went to his dorm room to collect his belongings.
Come in.
Oh, Mr. Burkett. Oh, you have my condolences.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, a student found this.
How did you get this?
I'm sorry.
According to Tom and Beth, school administrators refused to provide any information about the student who had turned in Tommy's driver's license. It was another unanswered question to add to a growing list. Tommy's parents decided to canvass the neighborhood. They were stunned by what people had seen the afternoon of their son's death.
Several neighbors reported seeing a car chase, Tommy's car being chased by a larger, darker car. One neighbor in particular had a very clear recollection. He said he saw the cars coming and he thought, this is serious, it's life or death. Another neighbor reported that one of the cars involved in the chase at one point drove through someone's lawn. Tommy's car was apparently run off the road and he was assaulted. He got away from his attackers at that point and made it back to our house.
Two other neighbors reported seeing a peculiar incident at around 5:15 p.m., a time when paramedics said Tommy was already dead. One of the witnesses was willing to appear on camera.
What I remember about that night is that another neighbor of mine was coming over to my house, and she observed a car going around the cul-de-sac. It was Tommy's car, and it was going around the cul-de-sac with no lights on, and he was not driving in his normal manner. And as soon as she arrived at my house, she immediately relayed the story to me. You know, we commented about it for a while. We stood out on the porch and chatted for a minute. And whoever was sitting in the car did not get out of the car until after we went inside. We thought it was very strange that no one had contacted us from a law enforcement agency to find out if we did indeed know anything or not.
At the insistence of the Burkettes, we did go and talk to all the neighbors, but no information was developed from those discussions that would change the information that led us to believe that it is a suicide.
Tom, come here.
A few weeks after Tommy's death, Beth noticed a spray of small reddish marks on the stairway.
It looks like scattered faint blood stains.
But what would it be doing on the stairs?
Earlier, Beth had noticed other spots near a doorway downstairs.
We have to have someone come here and look at this.
Beth and Tom informed the authorities, but no official investigation followed. Tom and Beth then made a bitter decision. Tommy's body was exhumed for a second autopsy. The new findings added to their growing belief that Tommy had been murdered. The second autopsy revealed that Tommy had unexplained abrasions, bruising around his right ear, and he had a broken jaw. Tom and Beth hired Paul Kish, a bloodstain expert from the Laboratory of Forensic Science in Corning, New York. He determined that the spots were in fact blood, though he could not determine whether it was Tommy's.
It's not consistent with being created from an individual committing suicide in a room sitting on a sofa. Some other violent altercation took place where blood was shed, with a lot of energy being exerted towards the blood, like a gunshot.
This spent bullet was found in Tommy's room. It bolstered Beth's suspicion that the suicide had been staged.
At our laboratory, Professor McDonald did a analysis of the lead core, which was pulled from the wall, and was unable to identify any kind of tissue, which you would expect to see if it passed through the skull. And he also had a negative test for blood.
To Tommy's parents, a terrifying picture of his last hours had begun to emerge.
I'm calling about some information concerning my son, Tommy.
Beth resolved to find out if her son had telephoned for help on the day he died.
Do you have any records of him making any 911 calls that day? He did call twice. What did he say?
She said, well, on the computer screen, it shows his name and the login number and the time that he called and that he made two consecutive calls, but the message has been deleted.
Well, how can I find out what he said? I really need to know what my son said.
And she said, well, let me check with the supervisor.
Also, do you have any records of any complaints he may have made against any persons?
She said, yes, he had filed a complaint at the end of October and at the end of August.
What was the nature of the complaints?
She said, well, I'll have to check with my supervisor. So she left, was gone several minutes, and came back and said, I don't know why his name is on the computer, but he didn't call 911.
I'm not familiar with who they spoke with. I do know that there's no information to indicate that Tommy had called 911 prior to his death.
I know Tommy made the calls because the police department personnel told me. I know this to be a fact. I'm angry every day of my life. I wake up angry every morning that this police department did not respond to the 911 calls.
It's my understanding that the information that the Burkettes came up with about the 911 call was well after the 30 days, and the tape that would have been on the machine that particular night had already been routinely erased.
If Tommy did indeed call 911, were the official phone records innocently erased or deliberately purged? More importantly, if Tommy had called, why were his pleas for help ignored by the authorities? Tommy's parents began to closely re-examine a strange series of events that preceded their son's death. It began with a phone call from Tommy around November 12th, less than 3 weeks before he died.
Hello?
Mom, they smashed my mailbox and took my paycheck. They took everything.
Calm down, Tommy. Look, get in touch with payroll and tell them to stop payment on the check.
It's not the paycheck I'm worried about.
Tommy was normally very poised, very calm, and he was just frantic.
I'm not sure it was in there.
It's okay, hon. What do you think was in there?
Well, something I didn't want anyone to know about. I think they found out what I'm doing.
And I took it to mean that since he was not positive they had found something out, he was not going to divulge exactly what he was worried about.
Beth says that a few days after the mailbox break-in, she had a troubling encounter with a student on the Marymount campus.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Good. Have you guys seen Tommy today?
No, we haven't. But when you find him, tell him there's three guys looking to beat him up.
We were later told that the same young man who made the threat, the next night on the 15th of November, assaulted Tommy in a location off campus.
According to Beth, several sources told her that Tommy confronted his tormentor a few hours later.
What's wrong with you? Why do you keep doing this to me? Why don't you just leave me alone?
We were later told by a student at the university that the young man who had Tommy's driver's license after he was dead was the same student who had beaten Tommy up.
There may have been some indication that Tommy was involved in investigating drug activity on the Marymount campus. And that may have been one of the reasons why we still don't know to this day what really happened to Tommy Burkett.
A number of sources, mostly anonymous, have come to us and helped us piece together a story. And in most instances, their accounts corroborate each other. And what we've learned about our son was that he was a paid DEA informant, that there were a group of students on the campus who were dealing drugs. They felt Tommy knew too much and that they conspired with others to kill him.
Beth and Tom now believe that their neighbors unknowingly witnessed Tommy being chased by the killers. They also believe Tommy abandoned his car and made his way home in time to place the 911 calls. Then the killers burst in. According to Beth and Tom, an informant said Tommy was beaten to death with a baseball bat. Phone books were used to minimize bruising and absorb the blood spatters.
The story fit in with everything we had noticed and could not account for during the previous months. For example, we had noticed our phone books were missing the week after Tommy died. Also, we had told the police we were concerned because there had been a ball bat in Tommy's bedroom and the gripping tape had been stripped off the bat, and that had not been done by any of us. We understand the students had assistance in staging the shooting in the room from persons more knowledgeable about law enforcement and crime than they were.
Tom and Beth have names of the students they suspect were involved in Tommy's death. There's not enough evidence to say their names publicly at this point, but I believe with some of the evidence they've collected over the past 2 years that they may have the right people.
It has been determined in the and it's going to be maintained that it is a suicide until substantial, credible information is brought to us. At that point, we will examine all the information, just as we have for the past years. But again, credible information is what we're seeking.
There's this sense of rage that nobody's doing anything. No matter how much information is dumped in the laps of law enforcement people, they don't do anything. The response is the same. Everything's all right. Everything was done wonderfully. Everything's fine. And they think if they say it enough, it'll be true. It won't be. And we're not going to stop saying it's not.
when we return, a treasure hunt that is not for the faint-hearted, but some think $400 million in gold is worth the risk. It is only a speck of rocky land just east of Wisconsin, surrounded by the chilly waters of Lake Michigan. It is called Poverty Island, an apt name, especially when treacherous storms sweep in across the lake without warning. Furious winds and lightning swift currents have spawned a graveyard of sunken ships, and over the years, intriguing tales of lost treasure. One legend in particular professes that just offshore of Poverty Island, there are five chests stuffed with gold bullion and coins, which would today be worth more than $400 million. It might sound far-fetched, but the promise of millions in gold is enough for Richard Bennett, a professional diver and author of Deep Quest. Bennett has spent more than 20 years and $100,000 of his own money searching for the sunken fortune.
What we're going to do this morning, okay?
Gotcha.
So we just kind of put it together?
Any story that lasts or survives 100 years has to have some validity to it.
I think once we got it together...
If they survive 100 years, they probably have an 80, 85% chance of being true.
But how could $400 million in gold end up on the bottom of Lake Michigan? It all dates back to 1863. The tide of the Civil War was turning in favor of the Union. The beleaguered South, strapped for capital, put out a desperate call for relief to England and France. According to the legend, the Emperor of France, Napoleon Bonaparte III, answered the plea and arranged a clandestine shipment of gold to the Confederacy. With the southern ports blockaded, the gold was quietly packed into five chests and shipped across the North Atlantic to Canada. The secret shipment was then spirited hundreds of miles down the St. Lawrence River and clear across the Great Lakes to Escanaba, Michigan. There, the gold was hustled aboard a 60-foot schooner for transport to Chicago. Some say the ship was attacked by French mercenaries and sunk. Others that it was shipwrecked in a storm. In either event, the chests of gold were never recovered.
The legend is very consistent in several ways, and I think that's one of the most intriguing things about this legend is that it's consistent in that the loss is always at Poverty Island. There's always five chests, and it's always the same scenario.
And over here, she shows as being lost.
Historian Chuck Feltner disagrees. He has spent years in the Great Lakes searching for shipwrecks. He believes that the legend of the treasure makes for good storytelling, but maintains it is just that, a good story.
And that's 257 tons.
Records of shipwrecks on the Great Lakes in the year 1863 were extremely good. We've not been able to find any evidence that any of these vessels that were recorded to have been lost were sunk in the vicinity of Poverty Island, or that they were French vessels, as the legend would have it to be.
This is not the kind of activity that people would normally document with enrollments and this kind of thing. This was more of a secret activity, and they would not want to be broadcasting it.
Despite the lack of a paper trail, the legend of the secret shipment has grown, fed by rumors and speculation. In 1929, a group of sailors were said to have snagged the five chests with their anchor. Up it came, just seconds away, a fortune in gold, when suddenly the chains broke. The treasure plummeted back to its watery grave. A few years later, a group of investors in Chicago allegedly raised $50,000 to try their luck at Poverty Island. A young boy named Carly Jessen, whose father was a local lighthouse keeper, was said to have watched the salvage operation for three consecutive summers.
One day, he was sitting on the rocks watching this operation, and there was a lot of rejoicing, revelry, obviously a real congratulatory party that was going on the ship.
According to the boy, in the third year, a sudden storm arose, forcing him to return home. That night, the salvage ship allegedly sank with all hands on board. The heartless tides of Lake Michigan had once again reclaimed the Poverty Island treasure. Today, some 60 years later, Richard Bennett feels certain that he will succeed where others have failed. Bennett has devised an ingenious underwater sled to comb the murky depths of Lake Michigan.
The only way to really find this treasure is to have human beings on the sled, visually looking at the bottom. It's cold, it's deep, the area is very treacherous. Rocks as large as sofas are moved around on the bottom. But I'm a dreamer and I'm a gambler. As long as I have those things working for me, I'll probably continue to do it.
Will Richard Bennett ever find the Poverty Island treasure? Only time will tell. But a word of warning to any would-be treasure hunters. The waters surrounding Poverty Island can be extremely treacherous, even for the most experienced divers. Next, authorities need your help to capture a man convicted of kidnapping and murdering his own sister-in-law. April 25th, 1979. An intoxicated 29-year-old man tentatively made his way to a Catholic church in Everett, Massachusetts.
Father!
Timmy!
There's something I need to tell you. Can I come inside?
Yes, certainly, lad. Come in.
You have to help me, Father. You have to help me get this weight off my shoulders.
The man's name was Timothy Berry. He was about to make a stunning confession.
I'm the one that kidnapped Nancy.
Incredibly, Tim Berry had confessed to kidnapping his own sister-in-law. In that dramatic moment, he also became a murder suspect. 23-year-old Nancy Brown had vanished 16 months earlier from the house she shared with her mother and sister. Nancy was still missing. It seemed too bizarre and horrendous to contemplate. Could Tim Berry have killed Nancy Brown? Nancy, who idolized him like a brother. The seeds of this tragedy were planted when Tim Berry married Nancy's sister, Andrea Brown. Andrea was the oldest of four daughters, and when their father died, Tim became the unofficial head of the family.
You want some marshmallows? Oh,
yeah. It was the brother that my sisters never had, and the whole family just loved him. Tim's upbringing was very similar to my own. His parents brought him up very Christian. He believed in the same things I did, very family-oriented. We all just became as one.
They remained as one for seven happy, basically contented years. Then came Thursday, October 6th, 1977. It was Nancy's regular day off, and she got an early start doing laundry. The only other person in the house was her younger sister, 16-year-old Maura, home sick from school. Early that morning, Maura heard Nancy slam the door to the back porch and turn on the radio in the kitchen. That was the last anyone saw or heard of Nancy Brown.
A little while after supper, my mother called wondering if I had seen my sister, which usually wouldn't have been abnormal for me to have seen her during the course of the day. And I hadn't spoken to her. And they told me that nobody had seen her all day.
Mary, have you seen Nancy today?
Tim and Andrea, and Andrea's sister Allison, rushed over to the house and started calling Nancy's friends.
She hasn't seen her today.
Oh, my God. I know something's happened to her.
Nothing's happened to her.
Just calm down. It's just
not. Both Andrea and Allison were 8 months pregnant. They tried to keep themselves and their mother calm.
I talked to Margaret.
And the neighbor?
Yes.
Did you talk to her friends?
Yes.
I wouldn't worry about it, Ma. There's lots of places she could be. She probably went shopping.
Yeah, I agree with Allison.
In retrospect, Tim's behavior seemed out of kilter.
Did you look around? Did you look in her room?
When Nancy disappeared, Tim was there with everybody, very concerned, wondering what happened. But he seemed to be more nervous than what the rest of us were.
I'll go downstairs and check the washer.
Okay, you check the basement, I'll check her room, and I'll look at her address book and see if there's anybody we haven't called.
The group split up to search the house again. In the basement, Ida Brown found the one clue that had been left behind, Nancy's glasses.
The fact that Nancy's glasses were found on the floor of the cellar was particularly disturbing because the car was gone. Nancy was blind as a bat. She had to have the glasses at all times, especially for driving.
The very next day, when she did not appear or report for work, we conducted an investigation as to the place that she was employed and also the place she was last seen. We also were looking for her car, and on the second day, I believe, we located the car in a shopping mall perhaps a mile from her home.
Paul, there's no damage to the ignition.
Interestingly, Tim Berry had been the one who suggested to police they check that particular shopping mall. Nancy's car was unlocked, the keys lying under the seat. There were no apparent signs of foul play.
When they went to look at the car, they found out that she had an alarm in it. The car alarm was not set, which is unusual for Nancy. She always set the alarm, and there were a few particles of sand inside the car. But that's all that we had at the time.
An abandoned car and a pair of glasses. The clues were sparse. Yet the ominous possibility loomed that something terrible had happened to Nancy Brown.
We all tried to settle into a normal life, trying to make things as natural as we could. We were always hungry for any news. We always tried to think of possibilities.
Are we all the way through the night already?
That's great.
How are you feeling?
Good.
You ready for another?
Allison had her baby just days after Nancy disappeared. Andrea and Tim's second child was due any time. The sisters still hadn't given up hope that Nancy would return.
I wish Nancy were here.
Me too.
Me too.
But Tim evidently had.
Will you stop talking about it? She's gone. There's nothing we can do about it.
Tim seemed to be a little bit more withdrawn, a little bit more moody than he normally would have been. He wasn't acting himself.
According to Andrea, Tim had begun to drink heavily. Unbeknownst to her, the police had asked Tim to take a polygraph exam. He had refused. The police began to check into Tim Berry's background and soon found an alarming skeleton in his closet. While stationed in Germany with the U.S. Army, Tim had been charged with the murder of another soldier. A military court found him innocent, but the record did note his so-called clairvoyance. How he had led authorities to the location of the murder weapon and the body. Police now began to believe it was more than coincidence that Tim had known where to look for Nancy's car. Still, there was no hard evidence against Tim Berry until April 25th, 1979.
I'm the one that kidnapped Nancy.
That was the night, nearly a year and a half after Nancy disappeared, when Tim Berry made his dramatic appearance at the church.
I knew that Nancy, on the days off, would do laundry at her mom's house. So I broke into the house about 5 a.m. and waited for her down under the stairs. I could hear her moving around up there. And she walked down the stairs. And I came up behind her. I grabbed her, and I blindfolded her. so she couldn't see who it was. And then I put her in her car, and I made her lie down in the front seat.
I know who you are!
Get back down. Get down.
Timmy, I know it's you!
Tim told the priest he had worn a fake mustache so no one in the neighborhood would recognize him. He said he drove Nancy to a beach in Ipswich, Massachusetts, 20 miles north of Everett.
Nancy, shut up.
Tim Berry forced Nancy Brown to walk through the dunes into a heavily wooded area. He carried a hunting knife and a military entrenching shovel.
Tim, you're crazy.
No, I'm not.
Something like this.
Tim told the priest that when Nancy stood up to him, he decided to end it.
And no one will ever know.
I hit her in the back of the head with the shovel and the knife. I slit her throat. I buried her and threw the shovel away and buried the knife.
I know it took a lot of courage to tell me this story, Timmy. But don't you think it'd be wise if you told it one more time to the authorities? Do you think you can do that?
When he first confessed to us, he was cool, calm. It seemed like he had a burden on him. He wanted to get it off his chest, and he told us from the beginning, you know, I just said to him, Timmy, you know, all these years, it's been over 16 months, the investigation's been going on. Why didn't you confess before? Why now? He said, because nobody had ever asked him the question, did you murder her? And if that had, he said he would have confessed.
Later that night, Tim Berry led the authorities into the woods behind the beach at Ipswich. One of the police officers present was Patrick Della Iacono, a friend of Tim Berry's from childhood.
It's 30 meters over there.
The terrain itself was difficult walking. The sand was very sandy. It was tough on your feet to walk. And Timmy kept looking up at the stars, and I questioned Timmy why he was looking at the stars, and he said, that's how I find my way to where we're going.
So, Timmy, you know your way around these woods pretty good, huh?
Well, yeah, in the Army, I was training the special services.
Yeah? I bet they taught you all about this stuff, huh?
Pat, I could live in the woods and you'd never find me.
It took more than an hour, but Berry finally brought the group to the spot where he had killed Nancy.
She's over there.
In a shallow grave, police found the body of Nancy Brown. She had died exactly as Tim Berry had said.
Okay, Tim, we found her body. You can be arrested.
When he was asked why did he do it, Tim never would tell us why. He just said, this is the story, this is how, don't ask me why. And we. Even though we asked, we never got an answer. We never had a motive.
I just went to pieces. I couldn't believe that something like that had happened. I didn't want to believe my sister was dead. And I couldn't believe that he had anything to do with it. It just, at that point, it didn't seem like that was his nature. And I think the whole family went into total shock. Was just something that was too horrible to have to accept.
On February 11th, 1980, Tim Berry was convicted of second-degree murder and kidnapping. He received a life sentence plus 5 to 10 years. For 8 years, Tim Berry made a good show of contrition. According to Andrea, Tim remained a loving and dedicated father, even behind bars. Berry also came to be regarded as a model prisoner and was regularly assigned to work details on the outside.
Hey, Barry.
On election day 1988, Tim Berry was part of a crew repainting the Department of Corrections offices in downtown Boston.
14,000.
We'll need about
that particular day, the building was very busy. There are voting polls on the first floor of the state office building here. People coming and going all day long. Elevator traffic. The inmate work crew, approximately 10 inmates, were working with an officer-supervised work crew. Timothy Barry, part of that work crew, was assigned to a specific area painting offices.
Boss, I'd be glad to hear that.
I need to go to the camp.
Here you go. Remember where it is, right?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on.
It's our understanding that he requested of the officer that he go to the men's room, use the facilities, at approximately 9:30 that morning. About 15 minutes later, the officer realized that Tim Barry had not returned to his work area upon a check. And we soon realized that the subject had left, taking an elevator down to the first floor and mingled into the traffic, the floor traffic of the people voting and the pollsters, and blended into the crowd and just took off and fled the area. We initiated a ground search, and that search revealed absolutely nothing, as if Timothy Barry just disappeared into the sun, gone.
Nearly a year and a half later, Tim Barry walked out of the woods in Vermont. His children, then 12 and 17, were visiting Tim's sister for Memorial Day.
Is that Dad?
What? Hey, that's Dad.
I had to work, so I didn't get to go to the family vacation home.
Where you been?
I don't think anybody expected what happened. As a matter of fact, I'm certain of that.
I'm never gonna see you guys again.
Where are you going?
I just have to be by myself. I need to be alone. Obey your mom. Say hello to everybody for me.
Dad, come back.
Tim Barry had stayed for only 10 minutes. It was the last time anyone in the family saw or heard from him.
I can't say that I'm frightened, but I have to admit to once in a while looking over my shoulder, wondering if maybe he isn't someplace watching. I know he would never do anything to hurt the children or put the children in a position where they could be hurt in any way. But I have to admit to wondering.
Timmy Barry is an extremely intelligent individual, convicted of murder, sentenced to life imprisonment in this state, and he is to be considered extremely dangerous.
I want to see Tim caught and brought back to incarceration. I mean, he did commit a murder, and he does owe his debt to society.
Update. Timothy Barry is once again behind bars. As a direct result of unsolved mysteries, Barry was arrested this past Monday in Akron, Ohio. Barry had been working there as a truck driver using the name John Prendeville. At a hearing in federal court on Tuesday morning, Barry waived extradition and was remanded to the custody of the U.S. Marshals for transport back to Massachusetts. For every mystery, there is someone, somewhere, who knows the truth. Perhaps it's you. Join me again next week on Unsolved Mysteries.